I was wondering, like, when you say in the field of academic Irish history and this trend more generally in academic history towards a cultural or a social history, what implications does that trend have for our understanding of Northern Ireland and Irish history?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at how academic history changed even in the 1960s and 70s, you were getting a lot there about social history and social change. And that hasn't really found its way through to the curriculum. So, you know, sadly, those that are looking at a course, essentially Ireland under the Union, are basically going to do a course that's about dead white men. And that's a pretty terrifying place to be in this day and age. More broadly, some of the topics that have become major ones in the past 15, 20 years are to do with issues of commemoration. And that, I think, is something that is not really in the school's curriculum at all. So a lot of that is to do with how events are reinterpreted, misunderstood, politically used. That's not really something that's considered in much detail at school level. A lot of it, you know, in my own particular field, you've had a lot of work done recently about memorials of the First World War, for example. And there you get a situation where the Northern Ireland government puts up the Ulster Tower at Teepfal on the Somme in 1821, which is the first British war memorial erected in the Somme battlefields. That's often forgotten. And actually, you can say that was a reasonably sensible act, in that you weren't going to get any difficult or problematic parades because it was in France. Whereas what happens back in Ireland is a very, very confused and difficult story, where a number of what are sort of hardline unionist local councils don't erect war memorials until the late 1920s or early 1930s. So it's not that you have a sort of sense that unionists identify with the British war effort and that this is seen as an important part of the founding myth, if we like, of the Northern Ireland state. So sort of understanding how those things have changed over time is important. But that's not reflected in the school's system at the moment at all. And you get a fairly, what you used to get anyway, at Key Stage 3, when there's a requirement for pupils to look at Ireland sort of 1800 and 1820, was students were meant to be surprised that large numbers of Irish Catholics had served in the British Army during the First World War. And that was sort of where the discussion ended. It wasn't about the experience of veterans from the British Army in Ireland after the war. It wasn't about how these things had been memorialised. There certainly was an attempt to link it up, which is a very important task to do with the events in Enniskillen, with the Poppy Day bombing. So how the memorial was being used as a political symbol into the 1980s. And then, of course, how it's rebuilt and the dead of that event are commemorated in it with the peace doves. These are all sorts of interesting ways in which the past is approached, understood, reinterpreted, that really don't find their way into the school's curriculum.
Tim's absolutely right in terms of examination work at GCSE and A-level, and the emphasis on political history actually tends to turn off quite a number of young people. When even at Key Stage 3, when the Nationalist and Unionist unit was central, quite clear talking to teachers, particularly in less academic schools, that sort of political history was a turnoff to a large number of kids. I do think that at Key Stage 3, we do have the flexibility to deal with some of the stuff that Tim is talking about, particularly how history is remembered and how it's memorialized. That surely is a really strong way to connect the past and the present. And the other thing I think we can do at Key Stage 3 with cultural and economic history, we should pick topics which demonstrate that, as well as division in Northern Ireland, there are many examples of people working together. Now, that's not to distort the situation, but quite clearly, it's a place where people on an everyday basis often find common ground. And I think there are good examples from the past that can be used to demonstrate that, first of all, people can come together, but secondly, also that not all people in particular communities think the same, that you have a spectrum of views on different issues in this place, and that it's important that some of those are represented, even if they are not majority views.
Yes, I think that's really interesting in regards to what that cultural or social history in particular offers to young people's understanding of the political context, that when we only focus our history on political representatives, then as you say, Alan, we tend to end up with a more uniform idea of this community believes X and that community believes Y. But when we dig down to, as Tim was saying, the fact that many Catholics or nationalists were fighting with the British Army, for example, we then understand that these political allegiances are not completely determined by community affiliation, and that actually they're a little bit messier.
If we have made one huge mistake in the last 30 years, we have not taught about multiple perspectives. We have taught about two perspectives, sort of monolithic blocks. And the impact of that, from my own research, would suggest that it leads young people to almost think that this problem is insoluble, that you you've always had and it'll always be. So I think the importance of school history representing different perspectives, the nationalists who went to the Somme, those from a Protestant background who made contributions to independence, all these things I think are important, but also to demonstrate to young people that these views are not fixed and that people through time are influenced by the circumstances in which they find themselves and that views can change.